26th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Josh Salem, Dave Johnson, and Onyx. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Kathleen Shannon, Nadia Romlagan, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. Podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Althea Billings. We are joined today in the studio by Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to talk about his new story. It's out today, called Portland City Council Demands Mayor Investigate Zenith Energy Agreement. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time with us. So this new piece of yours talks about the city council meeting on March 19th, and the council passed an ordinance that environmental advocates have been pushing for a very long time. What does this ordinance do?
Yes, so this sort of follows, you know, a couple of months of Street Roots reporting where we were filing some public records requests after the DEQ fined Zenith Energy for illegal construction and operations of pipes at its Portland facility. So with that context, the resolution essentially demands that the Mayor Wilson, open up an investigation into whether or not Zenith violated its franchise agreement. Essentially, every person or entity in the city needs to have a franchise agreement if they're going to be using and constructing within the city's rights of way. There is some question as to whether or not they did that, and so this will direct the mayor to open this investigation and determine whether or not that happened. It also, secondly, requires or urges the Portland City Auditor to open an investigation into how staff operated around that. More high-level staff, not just your average city bureaucrat, but high-level staff and how they actually went about that process.
I want to get into the background a little bit because it does come at the end of so much reporting and a long history here. But I'd love to get into like some of the background info. Why is Zenith Energy's franchise agreement considered so worrisome?
Right. I mean, this is something that, you know, the entities that companies are required to have, because if you're digging into the city's rights of way, if you're constructing pipelines, if you're doing these kinds of things, you need to tell the city about it. That includes, you know, pipelines. Chevron has these. Kinder Morgan, you know, sends, you know, a bunch of jet fuel to the airport. Northwest Natural, Portland General Electric, they all have these franchise agreements. And a violation of that is actually a pretty big thing that most companies would want to avoid. And Zenith didn't seem particularly concerned with that, but it kind of checks out because Zenith has never really been accountable for any of the state, city, you know, whatever, county violations that they have, you know, been found guilty of over the years.
What could be the consequences of the outcome of this investigation?
I think that, you know, it sort of remains to be seen what the city council will do with this once they get a report back on the investigation ultimately. But it can include up to revoking the franchise agreement. The mayor has that power within the city code. And that city code is, or sorry, with the Portland City Charter, and that whole section is sort of outlined in the resolution as to what the mayor is allowed to do. But he can cancel the franchise agreement.
That would be pretty major.
That would be really major. That would essentially mean that Zenith may not be able to do business in the city anymore.
So this was the March 19th city council meeting when this happened. What was the discussion like ahead of this vote? 11-1 margin, pretty significant for the new council that we've got going right now.
It was significant, and keeping in mind how much time we have here on the program, we could probably talk about this for a long time because the discussion went on for well over 2 hours. It sort of highlighted just how much this resolution is about Zenith Energy, but also how much it is about, you'll hear city councilors say, we're building this plane as we're flying it. And so they're trying to really build out what this government does, the tension between, you know, the branches of government, the legislative and the administrative branch. And that discussion was really, you know, it came down to whether or not there was enough time for public testimony. They talked about whether or not the city council should be able to direct the auditor at all, much less if they should be investigating staff for these things. There were some assertions made, you know, Councillor Steve Novick, who is the lone no vote, sort of compared the idea of looking into staffers, he sort of compared that to the Doge thing, sort of a Trumpian tactic. I think a handful of councillors were a bit offended by that and recognized that, you know, they're not talking about just simply going and laying off people who've done nothing, you know, government employees, but rather looking into what that process was and what high-level employees decided to do around this process to either keep the public involved or not involved at all.
As I read the article, you note some oddities around the timing of when Zenith requested the new land use statement. What's important to know about that specific thing?
You know, I'm not totally sure at this point what's important about that. And I think that it will be interesting to find out once this investigation is done. What I do know is that, you know, through these public records requests, I found that they had submitted, you know, Zenith had submitted their application for this land use credential on December 11th. It was dated on their letter. They sent it to DEQ. I asked DEQ spokesperson Michael Locke, when did they submit this? He said December 11th. Donnie Oliveira, the deputy city administrator who sort of oversees this whole process, sent an email to city councilors on December 12th saying that that they had not received it yet. That is interesting to me. I did call him. We Street Roots, again, through public records requests, obtained that Lux application on December 17th. And I got a hold of Donnie Oliveira by phone, and he told me that it wasn't complete until they had paid their fees, but that they had not received it yet was kind of the first thing he said. And then he said, I'm sorry, I have to get on an elevator.
Bad cell service in elevators.
Bad cell service in elevators.
Because you're going up and down. Yeah,
we had to hang up.
Okay. Well, that's interesting and something maybe to file away for the future. Well, also for this article, you spoke to Councillor Mitch Green, who was one of the co-sponsors on the resolution. How did he describe the significance of what City Council actually passed?
Yeah, for a lot of people, I think, in the city, you know, if you're just kind of like doom scrolling on your phone and paying attention to what's happening at the federal level, it can be very, it's really hard right now. It's very traumatic for a lot of us. You know, it's difficult for, you know, all the people in this room to continue reporting through these kinds of things. I know that's true for a lot of journalists around. Counselor Mitch Green told me, you know, that this is really intended to bring a sense of transparency around government processes regarding Zenith, but also how local officials should operate under this new form of government. There's such a huge opportunity here. Portlanders voted in this new form of government, and there's a lot of kind of tension and like decisions being made. You know, the tension isn't necessarily so bad. It's just how, you know, decisions are going to be made and how it's going to be so responsive to the people. So, you know, he said, just to quote, this is why it's so valuable to have citizen advocacy on issues from the environment to corporate influence, you name it, because you can move the needle in local government in ways right now it seems you can't at the federal level.
What do you want folks to take away from the article, or maybe more broadly, your extensive reporting on Zenith?
You did make it into this resolution. Your reporting did.
Yeah, I mean, that is, you know, on a personal level, that is a fun aspect of it, to kind of do this reporting that is, you know, really exclusive to us because we were the ones that started filing these public records requests. There was an effort, you know, in the meeting to take that reporting out. We have, I believe, three exhibits essentially for the resolution, and there was a bit of a discussion about trying to take those stories out. And for the most part, the counselors decided to vote against the amendment to pull those because they recognize how much important context there is here. And so I guess what people, you know, should hopefully take away from this is that, you know, reporting gets results. You can talk now to your city government and have them respond to you. And, you know, here we go. This is, you know, on a day where we are experiencing 76 degree weather, coupled with golf salt ball sized hail coming out of the sky and tornadoes, it's worth, you know, considering what we're doing to stop the expansion of fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. If our listeners are interested, where can they find more information or read this for themselves?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. We do our best to make a beautiful paper and put it out every single Wednesday. You can buy a copy from a vendor in your neighborhood. They accept cash, Venmo, and tips. You can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts? Anything else you want to add?
I really appreciate you all having me. This isn't the last step by any means, but it is going to be a very interesting step, and it has a lot of sort of consequences, you know, for the future of Portland.
Yeah. Was there a timeline on the investigation? I feel like we should establish that, actually.
You know, there was something that that could have been, you know, so there was an amendment made that to make it happen a little bit more quickly than it would have. It could have been pushed out until after the whole budget thing is done, like in June or July, before it would start and would cost like $1 million. That was pulled kind of at the 11th hour. And so I'm not exactly sure what the timeline is, but Mayor Wilson said that he would respect the council's wish here and do it.
Well, Jeremiah, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks to both of you for having me.
Yeah. We've been speaking with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, about his latest article. It's called Portland City Council Demands Mayor Investigate Zenith Energy Agreement. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Dave Johnson. More In Depth is coming your way in a moment.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Noreen Shaw, the Deputy Director of Government Affairs Equality Division at the ACLU. She's here to talk with me about the No Bailout for Sanctuary Cities Act, which Congress is expected to consider soon. Welcome to the show, Noreen.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. So President Trump's immigration orders have caused a lot of alarm and fear for our local communities. And there's been some solace for folks out here because Oregon is a sanctuary state and Portland is a sanctuary city. But that could mean becoming the target of this new piece of legislation. What can you tell me about this act?
Yeah, this is a really dangerous bill that we actually call the Defund Our Communities Act, because it would do just that. If enacted, it would cut federal funds to hundreds of communities across the country, freezing funds that are critical for our communities. We're talking about losing the funding that social workers, police officers, teachers, bus drivers, all of them, that they rely on to be able to serve our communities. And we're really concerned that communities are going to be hurt in ways, and we're talking about losing the local bus line, losing Meals on Wheels, just ways that have nothing to do with immigration whatsoever, that we think voters are really concerned about, and Congress shouldn't be handing this kind of power to the Trump administration at this time.
Like you mentioned, there is a wide array of programs that might be implicated. Is the act specific about what those might be, or more broad?
It's broad. It names federal funding for food, shelter, healthcare services, legal services, and transportation, but it leaves the door open to, quote, any funding being cut, and it would apply to any jurisdiction that is labeled a sanctuary jurisdiction. So for Oregon communities, it means the entire state, the state's funding that it gets from the federal government, but it also could mean local municipality funding, either because the local municipality gets matching grants from the state, or because maybe the local fire department or law enforcement agency gets grants from the federal government directly, and they would lose that funding if they are not willing to hold people for ICE in their jails.
Looking at this from like a national perspective, how many jurisdictions would be impacted by this act that have a sanctuary status?
Yeah, we don't know how the Trump administration will use this bill, but we're really concerned that they will use it to really the greatest extent that their imagination allows them to. So hundreds and hundreds of communities around the country, including a lot of communities that wouldn't even think of themselves as sanctuary states or sanctuary cities. And that's because of the way that the bill is written. It's really written in a broad way and says that if you as a jurisdiction are not holding people for ICE, no matter what the reason is, you will be considered a sanctuary jurisdiction. I've talked to law enforcement officials in different parts of the country. They've told me, I can't hold people for ICE because I don't have the staff to actually hold all these people in my local jail. Or I'm worried I'll get sued if I hold people for ICE beyond the release date that they'd otherwise be released under. So it's really putting local law enforcement agencies into a terrible bind. It's harming the ability of a lot of different kinds of public servants to do their job, because it's saying we'll punish you by taking away your funding for making a decision about how to use local resources. And we think that's actually something that should be offensive to people, no matter what their political stripe, no matter how they feel about immigrants and mass deportations. It's just, these are local decision-making issues, and it's not right for the federal government, for the Trump administration, to be coming in and trying to dictate terms.
Well, the No Bailout for Sanctuary Cities Act also brings in the Supreme Court case NFIB versus Sebelius, where the court ruled that Congress cannot attach coercive restrictions to funding programs. How might that precedent come into play here?
Well, you know, what we know from the Trump administration so far is that they've been threatening state and local officials, and it's really a campaign of intimidation, and we should see it as part of the threats to our democratic system as a whole, our system of checks and balances and powers between the federal government and the state government being divided and really independent in many ways. And what's happening here is the Trump administration wants to have an iron grip on all dissent in this country, all elected officials. For them, they need to toe the line. And if elected officials don't toe the line by this administration, they're being threatened with criminal prosecution and they're being threatened with defunding. And so we're at a really dangerous moment for our republic, where we need to make sure that Congress actually stands up for all of our rights, our civil rights, but also stands up for our democratic system of government that divides power, that has checks and balances, that say state and local governments can make decisions about how they use their resources, And if they decide not to use their resources for the federal government's agenda, that's okay, because we have that divided government. We have the ability of state and local governments to choose their own way. That's what was really at stake in the Supreme Court case that you mentioned, and what we're really concerned about as we look to these continued attacks on states.
How does this attempt to target sanctuary cities, sanctuary states, compare to actions taken in the first Trump administration?
Yeah, we saw some of these same attacks during the first Trump administration. And I like to tell people that everything that we are experiencing now, we saw something like it in the first Trump administration, but this is those attacks on steroids. And it seems to me that the Trump administration has been emboldened to really exert all the power that it believes that it has in this political moment. So while the Trump administration put forward claims in court during that first go-around that were rejected by those courts, that, you know, the idea that they could force state and local governments to do their bidding, to carry out deportations, courts said no, state governments have the right to control their own resources. Despite that, we see them coming back with this argument, the same argument that was rejected by courts, with even fuller force, with even more aggressively. We wrote the Department of Justice a couple weeks ago saying these claims that you're making about the law are legally baseless, but we continue to see them making those same claims. And unfortunately, the chilling effect is huge. You know, state and local officials are trying to make decisions about how they use their time and their money, and they're going to be concerned about the potential loss of federal funding that they really desperately need. It puts them into a real tough bind.
That kind of goes into this next question I had. Oregon has the oldest sanctuary state law in the nation, and it was strengthened again in 2021 through the Sanctuary Promise Act. Could a different type of federal legislation, a different strategy perhaps, override those protections?
I think we should feel pretty good about the Oregon laws being respected by people in the state of Oregon, by state and local law enforcement agencies that continue to be beholden to those laws, but only up to the point where we start to see violations. I know that's actually been a major concern in the state of Oregon, that, you know, some local law enforcement might decide that they're just going to kind of take the law into their own hands and take part in mass deportations. And that's a huge problem. So the law, the state law is valid, but that doesn't mean that we're always going to see compliance by local law enforcement. It's something that state authorities have to guard against. We need to continue to see enforcement of the Oregon Promise Act. And when it comes to the federal government's threats, you know, if the federal government took the state to court over its lack of participation in mass deportations, we'd see a lot of those same arguments that we've been making. And I think we'd see them run the course really successfully, that under the 10th Amendment of our Constitution, the state government does not have to provide its resources. It can't be commandeered by the federal government for a federal program, which is what immigration enforcement is.
As immigration and sanctuary cities have become, again, a target for the Trump administration, do you see that there's a need for myth-busting about, you know, what is possible and what's within their power?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the greatest myths about sanctuary cities is this idea that criminals are walking free in them, and that's completely false. Even in a so-called sanctuary state or sanctuary city, state and local law enforcement agencies can use ordinary criminal laws. They can they can investigate and arrest people who are non-citizens in the same way they do citizens. And once a person is arrested and brought into a local jail and fingerprinted, that information goes to the federal government, and it goes to the Department of Homeland Security, which can make a decision about whether to try to pick that person up from local custody and try to deport them. So it's really a matter of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, having made the decision to prioritize picking somebody up from local law enforcement. That happens in sanctuary states, that happens in non-sanctuary states, because it's a matter of a federal program called Secure Communities. What we do see is that ICE has got to make decisions about who it sees as a priority. I mean, they are not going to be able to pick up every single person around the country who's brought in for some kind of traffic violation. And that's where the rub comes in, because we can't ask local law enforcement agencies to pick up the slack when the federal government isn't bringing somebody in for federal charges. It can't be the case that the federal government can kind of transfer this responsibility for immigration enforcement to the localities without actually giving the localities any funding or any support to do that work. I think that's part of the real problem here, is that if you're a local, let's say you're a local prosecutor and you're trying to get people, you have reason to believe that somebody poses a public safety threat, you think that they need to be held in the jail for 2 days, but the local jail doesn't have space because they're holding dozens of people for ICE to come pick them up. For a local prosecutor, that from their perspective, that's really bad for public safety, because they are now having to let somebody go free who they think is a public safety threat because somebody else happens to be an immigrant and maybe they're on the most basic of charges, not really anything that would raise violence concerns. But unfortunately, the jail has been filled up by those individuals instead of the people who are deemed a public safety threat by local law enforcement.
What would you most want folks at home to know about the No Bailout for Sanctuary Cities Act?
I would want them to know that this bill, which should be called the Defund Our Communities Act, is a danger to their local bus line, to their Meals on Wheels program, to their ability of social workers and teachers and bus drivers to just continue to do their work serving our communities. This is way bigger. Wherever you stand on immigration issues and even on sanctuary policies, you probably agree that we need local government to function. And now is not the time to be cutting funding to our local governments, unrelated funding that goes to support American families all across this country through the provision of local services. We shouldn't be handing more power to the Trump administration to feed programs into the wood chipper. We need a lot of these programs. And we need people to be able to continue to do their jobs. And that's why we need people to oppose this bill and call their member of Congress.
If our listeners are interested in learning more, getting in action, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, they should come to the ACLU website, aclu.org. They can take action through our website. They can be patched in to call their member of Congress. And we really want people to do that, because even though the state of Oregon is considered by many to be a sanctuary state, there are still members of Congress who are considering whether or not they're going to vote for this bill, members of Congress who are from the state. If people are ready to take action, they know that they want to leave a message with their member of Congress or talk to someone at an office about this, they should text SANCTUARY, that's SANCTUARY, to the number 82623. That's SANCTUARY to the number 82623 to get connected to their member of Congress.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I want to just say again that this is a really crucial time for our democracy to make sure that our members of Congress stand up for people in their communities and push back on this this grab for power from the Trump administration. So encourage people to take a hard look at this bill, H.R. 32, and reach out to your member of Congress about it.
Well, Noreen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Noreen Shaw, the Deputy Director of Government Affairs Equality Division at the ACLU. She spoke with me about the No Bailouts for Sanctuary Cities Act, which Congress is expected to consider soon. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billing.
Hi, this is Ray Lynn, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Join me, Melissa Lesniak, creator and host of That Vegan Show, this Friday, March 28th at 11.